Welcome to Growth Uncut, a podcast that interviews different people from around the world to share their views on personal growth. We feel passionately about connecting communities and raising awareness around social justice, humanity, and relationships. And today we are really privileged to be joined by Dr. Wendy Fitzgibbon. Hello.
Hi there.
Lovely. It's so great to have you on Growth Uncut. And I'm really excited about our conversation about growth. But just to start off, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself for the listeners?
Yes, I currently work at the University of Leicester as a senior academic, but I come from a background that's done a lot of practical jobs. So I've worked as a social worker, a nursery nurse, a nurse, and a probation officer. But currently I work within a school of criminology. When I was a probation officer, I got very interested in crime and how you help offenders rehabilitate, and so that led me to moving over to academia, where I was free to study and research areas that I felt were important.
And I guess from all of those experiences, I imagine you've kind of learned about growth in lots of different lenses, almost, from the sounds of it.
Yes, in a sense, it's a bit trial and error, because I never really knew what I wanted to do after school, so I tried a number of different paths, but funnily enough, they've all been in the caring, working with people, social area, and opportunities have arisen and I've just gone with them. For example, I did applied social studies and social work degree, intending to be a social worker with young children and following up my nursing experience. Personal growth for me has always been about creativity, being open to new challenges, and not being afraid to take a few risks in your time so that you can fully reach your potential.
So in terms of those risks, you know, like taking risks, I guess, for a probation practitioner today in today's society, how easy do you think that is in terms of, I guess, developing their personal growth, but also their kind of practice?
That's a really good question, because that's part of the reason I decided to go into academia, in order to be able to critique what was happening in the criminal justice system and probation. And my PhD was actually on the development of risk assessment in probation, because I feel that with people, you've got to give them a chance to take steps. And sometimes they take steps in their work, and other times they take steps and they might falter for a while, and then it'll work, and sometimes it won't. I really feel now that we try and get offenders to jump through hoops all the time and prove themselves. Yes, they had to do that in the past, but they have to do it so much more now. And then what we can offer to them is quite negligible. For example, in The Guardian today, it talked about how many high-risk offenders are released out of custody with nowhere to go and no home to live in. And you think, well, how are you going to expect people to be able to find their path and rehabilitate and reintegrate if you're not giving them the basic needs of a home and the chance to have a good meal every day and the chance to maybe find work or education that will give them some personal growth? So I really feel that my motivation for going into academia was to throw a lens on how we help people to reintegrate, and that risk, you know, has to be measured with also opportunity, I feel.
Absolutely. And I guess that kind of leads me on to my next question, really, in terms of, you know, what are those things that, looking back on your career, maybe, or in your life, that you really value, would you say?
It's a good question. I think I value relationships. I think relationships are key, not just for your personal life, but in your professional life. And I think relationships are key for people who are trying to make a life after offending or after, you know, a crisis. So relationships, love, hope, creativity is really important. I feel that if you can tap into your creativity, whether it's producing a beautiful garden or a lovely painting or singing a song, it's really, really important. And I think with lockdown, that's really come to the fore, with lots of people trying new things and trying new avenues to be creative. I also feel you've got to value the community and relationships wider than just your own little network, and try and put into the community and receive from the community and value your environment and all those other things that are so key to having a valuable and useful life.
And we've kind of seen that a bit, haven't we? I guess during this time of kind of disconnection in some senses, but it's been really lovely to see how communities have come together, you know, whether it's through clapping for the NHS or whether it's playing music on the streets. You know, I think there's been opportunities, haven't there, for different connections, I guess, relationally within our communities.
Oh, most definitely. And I've seen that on my street. I've seen that. I got involved in a wonderful writing retreat, virtual writing retreat series on a Wednesday, which was a real lifesaver because it really reached out to academics and writers all beavering away individually under lockdown. And it was a really great opportunity. And I want to thank Marcella for facilitating that. It enabled people to reach out and communicate with people they'd never met before, but had the shared interest of wanting to create and write. And yeah, that was very valuable. And I know that there's lots of initiatives like that that have happened from friends and family. And I think it's great to see.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think there's something about, you know, I think during my time over lockdown, I've done things that I never thought I would have achieved in my everyday kind of humdrum work, you know, like I'm constantly working hard every day. And I kind of think when you have that space to reflect, you suddenly different doors open that you wouldn't really have,
exactly,
wouldn't really have done. And I think that's growth in a way, you know, in some senses,
yeah,
as well.
Most definitely. Yeah.
So you talk a little bit about relationships being really significant for you. So who would you say is your inspiration? If you could name someone, and well, not necessarily name someone, but who is your inspiration, and why are they, why are you inspired by them?
I'm very lucky that I've been inspired by a number of people. My parents, obviously, because they were very loving parents and were very encouraging. Although I came from a poor background, I was brought up in a council estate, and my mum and dad really valued education and encouraged me to use it as a vehicle to fulfill myself. And that has helped me and my brother and sister. And my sister is an inspiration because she is very creative and very positive and very feminist. And that's wonderful. And in terms of academia, I think the Middlesex Criminology School, where I did my master's, and John Lee particularly, have been really inspirational and supportive in my career. So, and I've met some other wonderful people along the way, Fergus McNeil, yourself, various other people that have helped me and encouraged me. And but I am very blessed that I've had, you know, a very good mentor in John Lee.
And what would you say is about John Lee in terms of him as a character, or in terms of his knowledge or his advice? What is it, do you think, that has helped your growth and supported your growth?
One of the amazing things is his humility, and that he's not a big note. He's not somebody who's out there bigging himself up. He's very happy to be supportive in a quiet way. And although obviously he's a very well-known figure, I think he's helped a number of academics to reach their potential. And not just me, I know of a number of other people as well. And I think that's been really positive, in that I think to be a really good mentor, it's not about you getting accolades from it. It's about you being able to push the other person forward. And I'd like to think that I've done that with a few of the people I've worked with.
And I think it's really interesting you say that, because when you were talking, I was thinking about the governors in Norway when I was working out there, when I was an academic. And they, in terms of a characteristic that I guess they all shared, it was very much that idea that they were really humble with their achievements or with what they'd kind of accomplished within their prisons. And I wonder what, you know, by being humble, what conditions that create for people, you know, whether it's that kind of openness or that kind of safety, isn't it, almost, that there's no threat here or there's no agenda here. It's just about that kind of openness to support your growth without any you know, kind of agreement or contract that you've got to give it back, or you've got to do, you know, jump through particular hoops. So I think
that brings me to mind my first senior, Joan Finley, who is also another inspiration, in that She was very much like that. She when you were a probation officer, she really pushed you and really believed in you. But not because it was about her progression, but because she wanted you to achieve what you possibly could, both with for your offenders, but for your own development. And I'm still in contact with her after all these years, and she's still exactly the same, still a quiet inspiration. And yeah, it's interesting. It's often those people that are quite selfless in a sense, in that they want to promote you and push you forward. And yeah, I think they are inspirational.
And in some senses, that feeds forward, doesn't it? So in terms of, I guess it's kind of carried on to you in terms of the way in which you mentor, but in terms of, you know, moving forward with those that you support, you kind of think that impact from the beginning has had that ripple effect, hasn't it, in terms of moving people forward and feeding that culture forward, which I just love.
Yeah,
I love that idea.
it's interesting because I remember when I worked at London Met, which was a great experience. I really enjoyed working with the students and the staff at London Metropolitan University. And I remember standing in one of their large lecture halls where I'd had my very first undergraduate lecture myself when I did my first degree at North London Poly, and proudly so. And I stood there and said, you know, I never ever thought I'd be standing here from my background and standing in the place where I had my first lecture to you. And that was lovely because I just felt, you know, how things go in circles, and it was a great experience to stand there and think, oh, what a journey I've had and what a journey all these people can have. And a number of people came up to me after that lecture and just thought it was really great that I'd gone to North London Poly too and managed to do what I've done.
And in some senses, I guess that leads us on in the conversation in terms of your challenges. And what would you say are your kind of biggest challenges, and what have you kind of learnt from those along the way?
I have experienced prejudice in that I remember when I got to grammar school and when they had grammar schools, and I remember they used to dismiss all the people that were in the council estate, and they said, oh, well, council estate kids don't have books in their house. And I always put my hand up, probably a bit too bravely sometimes, and say, well, actually, we've got lots of books in my house. And oh, and everybody on the council estates, their father go down the pub, and I'd put my hand out and say, no, my dad doesn't go down the pub, he doesn't drink. And I just hated that stereotype all the time that they were pushing, that, you know, working class people and certain people weren't as good as the middle class people. And also I was brought up in West London and near Southall. And one of the other things that really made me angry when I was at school was how they used to treat students who came on buses from Southall, where was near where I lived, to be assimilated. In terms of education. And my best friend was Behindajit, who was an Asian little girl who came from Southall. And she had to actually wear a badge that showed that she was one of the coach kids that had to go home and go. And they missed half an hour of school in the morning and half an hour of school in the afternoon to go on these coaches. And when I learned more about history, it really reminded me of the labelling. You know, of the stars and things like that that people had to wear. And I just felt the injustice of it. And I used to, and there were a lot of fascists, National Front at that time. And I used to get really picked on for going around with Asian girls. And it incensed me. It incensed me. And that sense of injustice, both in terms of class and in terms of race, and obviously gender, you know, has fueled me really. And I think that is one of the biggest challenges we all face really in the community of fairness and justice really. And so that's informed a lot of my research, a lot of my writing, and made me really keen to help people that are marginalized, not through any fault of their own often, but just through life circumstances. And you know, I want to go on writing and supporting people so that they can reach their full potential and get to be valued in society because of who they are, not what they are.
I completely agree. And I think it's what we see, isn't it? In terms of, you know, I've met so many people in prison who have just got utter talent, but have not had the same opportunities that I've had. And I kind of think, you know, there's a way in which we can see them, we can identify them, and we can place lots of labels on them. But when you strip that away and you look at who they are and what strengths and what character and what resilience they have, I just think there's so much there. There's so much there that we don't see, I guess, as a society, and that we don't see in our communities as well, in terms of that kind of stigma that kind of stays on their back as they kind of leave prison and try desperately to overcome all of these just immeasurable obstacles that are in their path almost. You know, looking at your experiences and what you've learned from that, and from the sounds of it, it really drives you now in terms of where you are. What would you say is that first step? You know, if we are going to move forward in terms of connecting people and building tolerance and creating more equal society, what do you think needs to happen as a first step in order to achieve that?
Well, I think it's got to happen from above, from a change of government. I would say that I believe that we need to rethink the resources and the divide between rich and poor, and enable everybody to have a stake in society, everybody to have a decent home, everybody to have a chance of a decent education that's free at the point of delivery, everybody to have health that's free at the point of delivery, and for people to, you know, value the environment. That's a really important thing. And so just little things that you invest in a community to show that actually the people that are managing that community care enough to employ enough people to empty bins. I recently did some work in Aarhus in Denmark, and every night they had, you know, people cleaning the streets with water and jets so that it was sparkly every morning. And so then you would feel terrible if anybody had dropped anything, because it would be so obvious, because, you know, and I know that's just one symbol, but I think it's a symbol of pride in the community. Everybody has a stake in the community. Everybody has a home. Everybody has the right to go to public spaces that are looked after. And I think, you know, I think back to my childhood, and you know, it was more like that in Britain all those years ago. But there were other, you know, discriminatory things, as I talked about. So I think we need to tackle all of them, really. And the only way to do that is to have a government that's committed to doing that and puts that first, above profit and above, you know, all those other things that we know people value more.
Yeah. And I think it's symbolic, isn't it? You know, when we talk about litter within prisons and prisons being essentially, you know, sometimes very dirty places.
They're awful.
But it's symbolically what that stands for people. You know, when people talk about it and what that represents, you know, that feeling that, well, we're not worth a clean environment, or we're not, you know, because of that, then we are just going to continue to make it dirty because no one's invested in us almost. You know, and I think the staff feel that as much as the residents almost. You know, if you look at the staff offices that are really hectic because life is so hectic, being able to have time to clean their offices or have renovation, you know, having funding for staff offices in prisons is just shocking. And, you know, it's all these things, like you say, they are the basic things, aren't they, that really significantly make a difference, not only, you know, physically, but also symbolically.
And I think there's been some quite interesting work about the taint of working with the contaminated or tainted people, and that actually goes on to the people like probation officers and prison officers. And that idea that, you know, if we condemn people and say, oh, you know, you're an asylum seeker, so you've got to live in a terrible detention centre, or you're a, you know, a prisoner, so you can just go and live in a Victorian prison with rats and cockroaches. What does that say about our civilization? What does that say about our our humanity. And I loved your pictures when you worked in that lovely, well, not lovely, but really well-run farm prison.
Yeah,
And you took all
Bastoy.
those pictures, and the value and the care the people took on their little personal spaces was obvious. And I went to a probation centre on one of my research projects outside Dublin, which was wonderful. It was creative, it was nurturing, and they took a real pride, not just the staff, but the offenders. They loved that place, they cared for it, you know. And then the pictures I took in my Photo Voice project showed how much they cared about the environment and all the lovely mosaics and paintings and gardening they'd done. And you only have to value people, then they will find their creativity, they will care for their environment. But if you condemn them and marginalize them and belittle them and have one rule for you and one rule for another, you know, that is just going to make people angry and kick off. And whether it's, you know, being anti-authoritarian or whether it's, you know, I don't know, dropping litter or road rage, all the things that we have now very commonly, because people just feel angry. And I get that sense of anger. Even when I'm walking my dog, I get that sense of anger out there. And it's sad. It's very sad. So investment and equality are those two things. That's the other thing I noticed when I went to Denmark, is how you didn't have that great disparity between what people had on the street. Because if you walk through London, the disparity is so obvious. Whereas you walk through Aarhus, the disparity, yeah, it's probably there, but it's far less extreme, and far and the environment is far more nurturing. Anyway, sorry.
Absolutely. No, I'm with you 100%. And equality is the key, isn't it? And I think giving people opportunity to grow, I think is just such an important aspect that we've got such a long way to go with it. But lots of going on at the moment, and I kind of think there's opportunities now. And through this kind of really challenging time, this pandemic, I wonder whether there are more opportunities to think about what do we want our new normal to look like? Do we want, if we have a more equal society, what could that bring? How could that help our economy? How could that help our growth and our kind of culture to be more Scandinavian, I guess, in that sense, in the sense of that kind of inclusion and equality and that idea that you are all a family under one sky. But yeah, a long way to go. But so interesting. And thank you so much for joining us on
Can
the
I add
podcast.
something?
Of
Sorry.
course you can. Of course you can.
Talking about that, can I plug my book? Is that all right?
You can plug your book, of course. You can.
When you were talking about that, Sarah, the opportunities that have arisen through this terrible crisis and some of the other crises we're facing that you know, many young people have been illustrating for us by climate change demonstrations and other demonstrations of Black Lives Matter. I really do feel we're a tipping point, and I've just written a book called Privatizing Justice with John Lee, and in it we look at the two scenarios. I think you're right. This could be a great opportunity to reinvest, to reinvigorate penal welfare, to reinvigorate society, to go for a more green perspective. We've shown in lockdown how the environment can change so quickly if you just stop overusing things like planes and cars. But very quickly we've reverted. So I do feel we're at a crossroads now. We could use this breathing spaces that we've all had across the globe to really make significant changes. Or there is another more dystopian future, which with all the conflicts and the certain leaders in society across the globe, that you can see that they haven't learned, and that it's all about posturing and privatization and making a profit and economy. And I really do feel that, you know, we could go to a wonderful new future, or we could go to a future more reminiscent of the film Blade Runner. and dystopian futures. I hope we go for the former, and then we can incorporate all the growth and the creativity and the opportunities that we've been speaking about today.
A perfect sentence to end on, Wendy. Absolutely. So thank you ever so much. And if you could send me a link to your book, then we could put that on the podcast as well.
You're fab. Thank you, my dear. That's lovely.